I'm so very pleased to be able to introduce today a wonderful speaker. I know I have heard of Rabbi Kenneth Hillander. Rabbi Hillander grew up in the Los Angeles area and has degrees from UCLA, the University of Judaism, and Hebrew Union College in Cincinnati. He served congregations in Ohio and in Ventura County before beginning as the spiritual leader of this temple in 2001. He currently also serves as president of the Fullerton Interfaith Ministerial Association. Would you join me in welcoming Rabbi Hillander?
Thank you very much, Mary. Happy birthday. And you did a wonderful job today. And I know how hard it is to stand up here. Actually, I know how hard it is to stand up there. Conduct a service or participate in a service. I guess I'm used to it. So I'm not used to being here on a Sunday morning. But I am very delighted to be back here with you again. I value and I treasure my personal and our temple relationship with the Unitarian Universalist Church in Fullerton. Marlise has been active in our Fullerton Interfaith Ministerial Association, of which I'm the president until January. And 2 years is enough. Not that I'm not staying involved, but got to give other people a chance. But I know we've worked together on a number of projects with Longest Night. Your choir is going to participate again this coming year. And of course, both of our congregations are big supporters of FIDE and a lot of other things in the community. A couple days ago, I was sort of watching my 9 going on 17-year-old daughter, Leah, as she was sitting, as she usually does, completely mesmerized by the flashing images on the what we call a television, it took me a little while to get her attention, and I said to her, because I was looking at whatever she was watching, and I didn't get it, you know, and so I said to her, I said, Leah, I said, what are you learning from this, you know? Well, I don't know if you know 9-year-olds, but my 9-year-old says, what do you learn from baseball? Now, in Jewish, we call that chutzpah, you know? She's got a mouth, as we say. But as my mother will remind me, you know, she hasn't. She does have 23 in my chromosome. So, you know, we have to wonder sometimes what we are teaching our children today. We have to wonder what kind of a society we live in. Many of us who are older, and some of you, a few of you are older than me, ask how it got to be so bad. When they're not covering the situation in the Middle East, night after night on the news, murder after murder, one abuse and abduction story after another, the violence never ends, never ceases, or amazes it to amaze or surprise us. And we all know the catchphrase of the media, if it bleeds, it leads. We're not shocked anymore. In fact, most of us have become totally desensitized to violence and crime. And as long as we are not directly affected or victimized, most of us either don't care or don't pay any attention. After all, we are secluded, protected, and insulated down here in the OC. Most of us live far away from downtown LA or the bad parts of Santa Ana, where most of the, quote, problems are. But do we not care about our society? Do we not care about our world? Do we not care about our children? One does not have to be a cultural anthropologist to know that a society is a weave of many different threads. Religion, music, sports, communal values, drama, work, relations between the sexes. And we all know that these elements of a given society are interwoven and interrelated. Now, if I told you about a tribe whose songs and dramas centered around violence and warfare, whose young boys violently competed with each other from the earliest age, whose sculptures, paintings, and potteries depicted battle scenes, Well, you would not be surprised to learn that this tribe's identity centered around violence and that it sought out warfare opportunities. So, let me tell you about just such a tribe. They're called the Kunari tribe, and they actually exist in Australia. They have many strict incest taboos and marital customs. As is often the case, the old men govern the society and have exclusive rights to marry the most attractive young girls, leaving virtually no mates for young men. Because of this, a young couple must elope from the tribe in order to marry. Once the villagers learn of this, they set out in pursuit of the newlyweds to kill them. The fact that the pursuers were likely married in the exact same manner doesn't seem to bother anyone. Moral anger is a norm, but if the couple can reach a safe destination, they may eventually gain acceptance. Now, by Western standards, we might say this is a crazy, irrational culture, but just imagine if the Kunari tribe were to come here to America to study our culture, our norms, and our values. Our television shows, movies, toys, music, and of course, the internet. All of these things which bonds all of our children and our society together. So what would they find? First, of course, we would have to show them our Declaration of Independence. We would tell them how much we deplore murder, assault, wife and child battering, sexual abuse, and rape. But then they would see our newspapers and watch our TV. They would learn that we have over 1 million of our citizens, mostly male, incarcerated behind bars. Their first question? Well, who are your children's heroes? Who are their role models? And our answer? The likes of Arnold Schwarzenegger, when he's not being the governor, Mike Tyson, and of course, a whole array of movie and sports stars. Are violent adventure films the only ones that your boys watch? No, of course not. They like comedies with lots of sex. But when they reach adolescence, they also discover slasher films, either on video or now. Only takes 2 seconds to find anything you want on the internet. And in these films, of course, the perpetrators are almost always male, the victims always helpless females. They watch television, of course, 28 hours a week on average, and by the time they reach the age of adulthood in our society, they will have viewed 26,000 murders, virtually all committed by men. Do they listen to music, the Kunari would ask? Oh, of course. In fact, they spend billions of dollars a year on these little metal discs called CDs and download thousands of songs from the internet, some legal, some illegal. Spend countless hours watching MTV with shows like Jackass, and they listen, of course, to the radio. So you have to ask, who makes all this music? Well, mostly angry-looking young men who use an indistinguishable language for their lyrics, who put scantily clad women in their videos and portray scenes leading up to rape. The Kunari would then flip around the television and find our billion-dollar sports industry, which makes heroes out of criminals, drunks, and wife batterers. Sometimes there's even blatant violence during the game itself as the crowd cheers on its warrior hero. The Kunari would see the drug and alcohol problem in our culture and see how pervasive the use in drugs and alcohol is among athletes and musicians whom our boys most admire, imitate, and dream of becoming. What do your young boys play with? The Kunari would inquire. Well, surely we'd take them to the toy store where we buy our toys. Have you ever looked at a toy store recently? Or even not so recently? It probably never dawned on you. But the store is actually divided into 2 sections, a boys' section and a girls' section. The girls' side of the store is pink and pretty, the shelves stocked with dolls and dollhouses, baby carriages, and cute little stuffed animals. Then you walk over to the boys' side. It's black and blue. The shelves are lined with guns, big, loud, realistic-looking and sounding machine guns, action figures like G.I. Joe, the Transformers, Power Rangers, and violent space age toys and games and video games. For sure, the Canary would have now discovered that young boys and men raised by single mothers had the highest rates of violence in our society. They would not be shocked to learn that having a caring, involved father decreased the chance of a young boy becoming violent. Well, why don't you encourage your young boys to become good fathers by buying them dolls and dollhouses and baby carriages like you do with young girls whom you want to become good mothers? Why do you train them for war, which most kids will never fight? Well, our society's professionals and toy manufacturers would politely explain that parents would never go for that. No parent would buy their boy a baby carriage. Parents, and why? Because parents are too afraid that little Johnny will grow up to be gay if he plays with little sissy girl toys. Well, by now, I'm sure the Canary would be completely perplexed. We Americans deplore violence, but we do everything in our culture to encourage it. The Canary would wonder why we don't realize that mostly heterosexual men become fathers, not gay men. What could be more absurd than to think that if little boys rehearse being fathers, the quintessential heterosexual role in our culture, the way little girls rehearse to be mothers, that they will become gay? But then the Canary would begin to understand, once they learned of our history of homophobia, and that we have a tradition of raising our boys to be tough, non-emotional, competitive, detached, and obsessed with dominance. In whose hands is the socialization of the next generation, they would ask. It appears as though those whose main goal is financial gain have the most influence on society and its children. Now look, we all believe in free enterprise as it led to the industrial nation which most of us enjoy today. But the economic exploitation of our children is taken for granted. The basest human tendencies are exploited by companies who just want to make a buck, and lots of bucks. Six-year-olds play with toys that encourage thoughtless violence, torture, dominance, and conquering of the world, and there's almost no question of their right to do so. We hear of story after story of a little boy finding his father's gun and blowing away his little sister. What do we do with that little kid then? What about our First Amendment, our right to free speech? We know, of course, that the First Amendment is not a blank check guarantee. There are limits. It does not apply to pornography, and that's why there are no Saturday morning pornographic TV shows for children. Although, again, in about 4 seconds, you can find anything you want on the internet. And the kids know how to do it, believe me. If you don't believe me, ask them. The Canary would wonder why we don't realize that what makes sense with respect to sex makes at least as much sense with respect to violence. Virtually no parent buys their children sex toys. To do so is illegal. Yet millions of parents legally and without thought buy their children toys and video games for them to participate in and act out violent situations. The Canary would soon learn that everything in our society is justified along the lines of free enterprise and free speech. Don't you Americans see that such a system actually leads to the enslavement of your society? They would ask. You teach them violence from birth on, reinforce the basest, most destructive tendencies in your young men, and then what do? You enslave them in prisons when they commit violent acts. Your women and elderly live in fear of being attacked, mugged, raped, or murdered. Many of our citizens are afraid to leave their homes after dark, and some even during the day. A few years ago, during a terrible heat wave in Chicago, hundreds of mostly elderly people died in their homes from the heat rather than even opening a window to expose themselves to the possibilities of crime. Is this what we call freedom? Soon, maybe we would realize that there are no absolute freedoms. You can't play loud music in the middle of the night if it disturbs your neighbors and their sleep. You can't call up the White House and advocate the throw of the government, no matter how much you want to do that, okay? Chemical companies cannot simply dump pollutants into our rivers and streams. They may do it, but it's not legal. There are laws governing virtually every facet of life here in America. So why do we believe that when it comes to the culture of violence, which pollutes the minds of our young people and all people alike, that there is an absolute freedom to do so? How many times during your worship service this morning, I was sitting right there, how many times did we pray for peace? But what is peace? How does it play out in our religion, our culture, our lives? The linguistic sense of the word can help us answer these questions. The ancient word for peace simply meant the opposite of war, and the Roman goddess of peace was a minor deity until the Roman Empire stood. Only since biblical times has the word shalom in Judaism carried with it a wealth of meaning. More than simply meaning an absence of war, shalom conveys safety, wholeness, completion, fulfillment, prosperity, health, and peace of mind. In English, we understand peace to be an absence of war or a lack of a conflict. But in Hebrew, shalom is not the absence of something, but the presence of something. Something that itself has to be created. And the creation, of course, must begin at home. Judaism stresses the centrality of what we call shalom bayit, peace in the house, domestic harmony and tranquility. In learning to live peacefully with those we love, we have to create shalom bayit, the results of which flow far beyond the walls of our homes. As individuals in society, we have to realize that parents and children, siblings and spouses and lovers do not exist solely to please each other. All individuals have their own needs, which have to be recognized and respected. In order to create shalom bayit in our homes, we have to take out the violence which pervades the walls. 20 years ago and more, children's television shows portrayed an average of 20 violent acts per hour. Per hour. Today, the average is over 50. 50 violent acts an hour. The shows our children and grandchildren watch are 3 times more violent than the shows we watched as children and young adults. And the average child is witness to at least 12,000 acts of crime, bloodshed, beating, or killing each year on TV, video games, music, the internet. The debate as to whether or not such shows have an effect on children and all people is moot. Advertising agencies spend billions of dollars a year to get you to buy their products. If it didn't work, they wouldn't advertise. So we have to ask, if the advertising works, is not the show itself just another advertisement? I've spent a lot of time around children, including my own, where I have 4. Children like to imagine scenarios. They like to play out themes and games in their minds. Many children today live the lives of their superheroes, who almost always solve the problem with violence. If you see 2 kids playing, they don't say, let's get the Secretary of State in here to broker a diplomatic solution. I've never heard a kid say that in my life. Well, some of you may be sitting there and saying, oh, come now, Rabbi. When I was a child, right, we played cops and robbers, cowboys and Indians. It didn't affect us. None of us are in jail. Well, that's true. But you did not spend every waking moment playing that game. You did not eat cops and robbers cereal or sleep on cowboys and Indian sheets. You did not have websites, movies, video games, posters, action figures, realistic costumes, and authentic looking weapons. When you wanted to make a gun, you held out your finger like this. Many of today's kids are completely enveloped in the lives of these simplistic and often harmful, if not blatantly racist, sexist, or non-compassionate good versus evil performances. They spend their days dreaming about conquering this imaginary warlord or that make-believe villain. Many children cannot turn off the scenario in their head. All you have to do is look at those 2 kids down in Columbine who rehearsed it over and over and over and over again, even videotaping themselves doing it. They never stopped playing the game. When they go to school, not when they go to school, not when they come home, not when they play with their friends, not when they visit grandma and grandpa, not even when they go to sleep. So what then is the solution? and where can it be found? Well, I'm a rabbi, therefore the solution is in the Bible. This Bible? No. Not this Bible. Put this Bible down. That Bible has some great ideas, but the answer's not in there. The answer's in this Bible, one of my favorite books. This book is called Boys Will Be Boys, Breaking the Link Between Masculinity and Violence. The prevailing thesis of that this book was written by Miriam Medzian, who is the child of Holocaust survivors. The prevailing thesis in the book is that in the United States, there's a link between masculinity and violence. Using Department of Justice figures, Medzian shows that far and away, the predominant number of crimes committed in this country are committed by males, and contrary to popular belief, the majority of those crimes are actually committed not against innocent women, but actually against other males. She puts to rest for the last time the endless debate over whether the problem lies in nature or nurture. She employs numerous studies and surveys which show that in most cases violence is taught and violence is learned. And even if you want to say that boys are born with violent tendencies, she says that boys can be taught to control those tendencies as they are taught to control their bladders. Medzian points out why we live in such a violent society, what specifically contributes to the amount of violence and against whom the crime is committed, and she gives us good solutions. Her strongest statement is that there is an identifiable problem and that we are not helpless. There are answers and there are solutions, although, like any answer and any solution, bitter pills and difficult choices will have to be made in order to make society safer and less violent. This book was written for parents who want to be empowered to raise nonviolent sons. She points out over and over again the falsity of the popular notion that boys who do not display power and dominance are wimps or effeminate. She counters with the idea that boys who are taught to be loving and caring people will grow up to be loving and caring and present fathers. This book is also a parenting handbook for prospective fathers who don't want to raise soldiers, cowboys, or other dominant, aggressive sons. It argues against the culture which has trained millions of young boys to go fight unnecessary and immoral wars, a society which has falsely equated loving, caring, and family commitment only with feminism, passivity, and weakness, and which has led to our children being simply a market to which to tap into and exploit for all the money possible. And since she wrote this book almost 20 years ago, let me tell you, it's gotten worse. So what are some of the solutions that she advocates that are still possible today? Medzian begins by pointing out that the acceptance of violence is a way of life in our society. And why is that? It's because male behavior is the norm, partly because of the myth that our national security depends upon dominant male leadership, and partly because of the acquiescence that, quote, boys will be boys. Medzian focuses on the absent father and the false notion that men cannot be trusted with children. She says that boys are not raised to be caring, loving fathers the way girls are raised to be caring, loving mothers. Any fatherly tendencies a young boy might show are repressed and condemned. Boys only get praised for aggressive, non-feeling, dominant behavior. And this is part of the problem which has led and leads to absent fathers. She answers the objections that men simply cannot raise children the way women can, as if you women are born knowing how to care for infants. You're not. You're taught it and you rehearse it growing up. Medzian describes in detail our culture of violence in which boys are raised. I talked about the sports, TV, movies, video, rock music, wrestling, the military look of the toy store. She didn't know of the internet, but we can add that now. Commercialism, which surrounds children on a daily, if not minute by minute by minute basis. She advocates stronger controls on children's television programs, on videos and music. She'd like to see professional wrestling matches, for example, limited to adults. Back in the 80s, that was a big deal. Today, that's nothing. Nothing compared to what you can see on the internet. She would like to see a change in the production of toys so that learning and development becomes the ultimate goal instead of profit. And all she wants children not to be looked upon by the business world as an untapped or undertapped resource for revenue. We can do something about the epidemic of violence in our society if we want to. Problem is, some don't see the problem. Some don't think that it is a problem or that it's not so bad. Some think the problem is unsolvable or overwhelming or not worth the effort. But we have to realize that something must be done, because violence in our society is detrimental to that which we value most in our society, that is freedom and individuality. In our Torah, for the Jewish people, we are commanded to seek peace and pursue it. In order for our homes to embody love and compassion, tranquility and understanding, we have to create an environment of shalom bayit. Not just in our actual homes, but in our daily lives and in our relationships. Of course, we have the opportunity to change the world around us, to further the values which we hold most dear and which have proven over the centuries to be universal values for all people. So let us not just pray for peace. Let us go out and create peace in our homes, in our lives, in our world. Let us not only seek peace and pursue it, but let us live peace, breathe peace, and teach peace. Amen. Now, all that notwithstanding, let me say a few words about the situation in the Middle East. All of the things I said are a nice philosophical argument, and of course I was limiting my discussion to our society here in America. The problem in the Middle East is obviously much more difficult. However, some of the same principles apply. Several years ago, I was sent this video. It's called Jihad for Kids. If you watch this, you'd be absolutely sick. Okay? What's on this video is what kids in the Palestinian areas, in Lebanon, in Syria, in Iran, used to be in Iraq, certainly Saudi Arabia, what they watch and what they are taught. They are completely indoctrinated with hatred for Jews and for Americans. And when we wonder, you know, how a kid can grow up to become a suicide bomber, or as I call them, a homicide bomber, this is really the answer. Just like our kids are indoctrinated with violence from birth on, many of those kids, even worse, are indoctrinated. And the images they use, I don't even see a little picture up here, this is a crude recreation of Mickey Mouse, who they use to teach the kids. That they're not going to listen to adults, right? They're going to listen to little, you know, fuzzy little characters who go tell them to aspire to blow themselves up and to kill as many Jews and Americans, of course, and Westerners, as possible. It won't surprise you that myself included, that to my knowledge and everything I've seen in the past couple weeks, that the United States Jewish community is 100% behind the state of Israel right now. The reason for that, of course, is that this is not an isolated incident. This is a battle, a war that has gone on for 58 years. And as many people have said, imagine if there was some, you know, militant group in Tijuana or somewhere in Mexico, and they were shelling thousands of rockets into San Diego. Just ask yourself how much the United States would, quote, hold back in responding. Now, whether that's right or whether that's wrong, it's necessary. In my mind, what I really think is happening is that there are probably a 10 or a dozen of these so-called terrorist groups, whether it's Hamas, Islamic Jihad, Muslim Brotherhood, Al-Aqsa Brigade, Hezbollah, on and on and on again. There's, believe it or not, there's competition between these groups, not to mention Al-Qaeda. They compete with each other. To who can get the biggest headlines and the most who can do the most damage, and who can put up a fight against Israel. And I personally believe that clearly on the exact day that Iran was supposed to respond to the United Nations on this issue of their nuclear ambitions, that instead of giving the United Nations an answer, well, they gave the United Nations an answer. They basically told Hezbollah to go and create a diversion. They killed 8 Israeli soldiers in Israel, took 2 as hostage. And of course, the part of their reason for doing so was to outdo Hamas in the West Bank that had done virtually the same thing a week earlier. And I'm sure Al-Qaeda is sitting somewhere, wherever they happen to be, thinking, gee, we used to be the number one terrorists, and now they are, so maybe we got to do something to get back into the news. You cannot, unfortunately, cannot make peace with people whose holy aim is to destroy you. How do you negotiate with people who don't recognize your right to exist? It just doesn't make any sense to me. And so, you know, Israel has made peace with Jordan, with Egypt, and with other countries, and things have dramatically improved in the last several years and last couple decades. The Palestinians could have had a state in 1947. They were offered a two-state solution. They rejected it. The Jews and the Israelis said, we'll take whatever you want to give us. If it's a square mile, we'll take a square mile. It was rejected time and again. In 2000, Arafat was at Camp David with President Clinton and Ehud Barak. And Barak, under enormous political pressure, basically gave away the store. 97% of the West Bank, including East Jerusalem as their capital. Okay, they could have had the state by now. Barak was giving it all away, and he would have been lambasted in Israel for doing so, but he took the unprecedented step of doing it. Arafat, you know, a terrorist who they gave the Nobel Peace Prize to, you know, what did he choose? Intifada and war. So, you know, I really don't know the answer. We pray for peace. I certainly pray for the peace of Jerusalem. I certainly feel terrible for the people caught up in the middle. It's always the civilians who lose. You know, some of you were alive during World War II. Lots of civilians lost at that time also. But right now, no country would allow another group, a foreign group, to be based on soil right across the border and to be, you know, shelling one-third of their population. No country would allow that, and you just have to wonder how much restraint any other country has shown. I personally believe Israel has shown an enormous amount of restraint, because if they wanted to level all of Lebanon, they could do it in one day. So I think they've shown an enormous amount of restraint. So I hope you'll join me in praying for peace. And unfortunately, Israel right now is having to fight Lebanon's civil war. And fight the war through of with Iran, who has obviously advocated the non-existence of the Holocaust and the destruction of Israel with their proxy. But you can't make peace with people who only want to aim to destroy you. Thank you very much. Well, you know, first of all, we have to live our own situation. Most of the weapons we have, of course, were you know, created and built up during the so-called Cold War, which personally I think was mostly propaganda, you know, against the Russians. You know, I think there is a moral difference. I mean, you know, you could argue that in general our you know, a weapon is a weapon, but of course it depends, you know, how you use the weapons. Look, Israel as a government, you know, as we do, I think, as Americans, and you know, we regret when people are caught in the middle. When Hezbollah indiscriminately sends missiles into Haifa, They don't care if it hits Jews. I mean, we saw a couple days ago, killed two Arab children, two Christian Arab children playing in their uncle or grandfather's backyard. When Jews are killed, there's dancing in Gaza. And I think that's the moral difference. Yes, sir. I have a theory that I'm continuously working on, because I don't know enough to know if it's right or not. But it's just a historical observation. At the same time, the Christian world and the Jewish world was going through a major Reformation period, hence the French Revolution and Reformation period, reforming the church, and of course the most important part of that was separating out the church from the state, all over Europe. Giving the so that the Pope didn't have civic control. The Christian world went through this major Reformation period, and the Jewish world did also. To be a secular Christian, is not an oxymoron. To be a secular Jew is not an oxymoron. We may not like it, but it's not an oxymoron. I think that in the Muslim world, It to be a secular Muslim is an oxymoron. And at the same time, like I said, in the 1700s, as the Christian and Jewish world were what we call modernizing and liberalizing their attitudes and their religious connections. In fact, there was a Reformation period in the Muslim world, but the Reformation went the other way. Instead of going so-called to the left or more liberalization, there was actually an intensification and a more what we would call Islamist point of view. I think we have just a couple problems. One of the problems for sure is the fact that there's no separation in most of these countries between mosque and state. The mosque is the state, and it's not the civic political leaders that have the power. It's the imam and the mullahs and the people that preach in the mosque. And look, as they point out totally correctly, any religion can be hijacked. There have been Jews, there have been Christians who use their religion to target and to harm and to kill others. Whether it's anti-abortionists or even the Jewish guy that killed the prime minister, or whatnot. Any religion can be hijacked. The difference is that unfortunately, and I don't know is that the to my I don't know if I'm right or wrong. My observation is that the Muslim world simply has not fought the civil war yet, and unfortunately, the fundamentalists seem to be winning. Yes, sir. Okay. First of all, I mean, Turkey is a fairly good example. Yes, it's certainly more democratic, certainly more liberal, certainly has more favorable relations with NATO and with the United Nations, and certainly with the West and with Israel. It's one of the very, very few Arab countries left where Jews actually live in any sense of population, because right now they're I think there are two Jews left in Afghanistan, and they hate each other, by the way. they fight. That's the way they hate. But again, there are, how many Arab states are there? 22, 26 Arab states, and unfortunately, Turkey is not the rule. Turkey is the exception, I think, unfortunately. I'm a small town rabbi. My job is to write sermons and probably to raise the conscious level of people. I hate to be pessimistic, but I don't think the society is not going to change. The advertisers aren't going to change. The toy manufacturers aren't going to change, except if one thing. So if people don't buy their product, they won't make the product. As simple as that. Our society is supply and demand. Look, if all of a sudden today the entire country said we all agree the entire country, not one of us is going to go to McDonald's ever again, there'd be no more McDonald's. They can't sell hamburgers if nobody's going to buy them, and they'd close up shop. So it's the same thing. when you buy your children toys, or when they're watching TV, or when they're surfing the internet, you know, we all have to make choices. And unfortunately, it's much more difficult because the choices and the options are much greater today than they were. When I was a kid, we had 3 channels or 7 channels here in LA, and the TV was, you know, went black at 11 or 12 o'clock at night. You know, now there are 150 channels. Some cable people have, you know, 500 channels, satellite. Again, you know, the internet, you know, so it takes 1 second, and sometimes you even stumble on this stuff without trying to stumble on this stuff. For example, if you go to whitehouse.gov, you get the White House. You go to whitehouse.com, it's a porno site. And any sixth grader can innocently do that. And let me tell you, you remember being in sixth grade? You know? Okay? I mean, it's not a matter of, you know, sneaking a peek at Daddy's Playboy in the bathroom. I mean, that's nothing. That's absolutely nothing. So it's the availability, let's face it. I mean, you're in a way. I mean, we're sort of fighting a losing battle. So yes. Okay. Well, first of all, there's never been a nation state called Palestine. There's never been a nation or a state. I mean, that territory has been called by the outside world, predominantly by Great Britain, but there's never been a nation or a nation state or government called Palestine. In fact, the people that lived there before 1948, Jews, Muslims, whoever lived in that land, were called Palestinians because that's just what the land was called. Now, the question we have to ask is, was it occupied before 1948, when Britain had it? Was it occupied before 1917 when Turkey had it? And was the West Bank occupied between 1948 and 1967 when Jordan had it? I was not alive back then, but I assume that between 1948 and 1967, there were not suicide bombers going off in Amman, Jordan. And there was no calls for a Palestinian state from the UN and from to get that territory back from Jordan. So, and before Turkey, and before them, and before them, and before them. Look, if you want to go back to at least what we know from the biblical text, the land is the Canaanites. But there aren't any more Canaanites around. And over the centuries, it's gone through many, many different peoples, and many, you know, different religions, and various peoples have had control of that very, very narrow strip of land. If we're going to return all, quote, occupied lands back to their original owners, then all of us sitting right here are in a lot of trouble, aren't we? First, let's start with, isn't Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands American-occupied territory? Isn't Hawaii American-occupied territory? Isn't California, right, Mexican and American-occupied territory? I'm just imagine, again, if there were a group of Mexicans who were freedom fighting to get their land back. Well, you might argue that not through violent means, but through immigration, and some of them, you know, do believe that, you know, this is still part of Mexico. The other thing that I would just ask you to learn about, you might already know, but you may want to look into how all of these Arab nations, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Iran, Iraq, Lebanon, Syria, how they all became countries. There's a bunch of men in England in a smoky room just wielding lines and just drew lines haphazardly. Iraq was never a country. It was 3 ethnic groups, and what'd they do? They just drew a big circle around it and said, okay, now you have Iraq. And that's part of the problem. Why the Shiites, the Kurds, and the third group, the Sunnis, why they're all killing each other. By the way, they've got very small mention. 100 civilians a day right now are being killed in Iraq. They're killing each other. 100 of the Muslims, the Sunnis, and the Shiites. Where the hell is the United Nations? Where's Condoleezza Rice? Where are the Arab countries? Where is the uproar? How many have been displaced? Where is the humanitarian crisis Anand is talking about there? I mean, if you're going to play fair, then play fair. That's all I say. Thank you.